How's that? Hi, everybody.
Hi.
My name is Stephanie. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. My home group is on Tuesday nights, 7 o'clock in Carbondale. It's a Carbondale AFG, real original. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting us down here. Really appreciate that. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you to all the speakers who have already spoken. The liar. Okay, here we are. Thank you. I want to thank all the speakers that have already spoken, and I'm going to thank the speakers that I haven't heard yet. I appreciate the service that goes along with this. Jack travels a lot, and I'm home a lot, so I know the commitment. I have an understanding of what that commitment is. I want to thank AA, particularly, for a couple of reasons. One, I am forever grateful for what AA has done for my husband, for my family, and for me. Lois talks about it in her story where Lois, our founder, she was invited to an AA meeting with Bill, and that's where she started finding what Bill had already found, and she thought it would help her, and she brought that message to other families and relatives of alcoholics. We work the same steps. We've changed only one word, and we carry the message to others and not the alcoholic. We've tried that. It didn't work so well. My sponsor, who I talk to regularly, she knows she's my sponsor. I know that I am sponsored. She reminded me that I'm supposed to share how I was, what happened, and how I am now. I wanted to read something because the reading helps me get here and get out of my shaky head. I also thought it was kind of funny when I came in the room. They're holding signs out there. This is Al-Anon. So you have come to the other side. Just so you know, when you came in here, you knew what you were getting into, and you could run away at any time. We have embarked upon an extraordinary, potentially life-changing spiritual journey, the journey of recovery from the effects of alcoholism. Every step we take on this journey moves us toward becoming fully the men and women we are capable of being. But we needn't wander aimlessly, struggling on our own without direction to find our way. Al-Anon's 12 steps show us the way. Through the steps, we can fill that empty place within us where loneliness and pain reside. We come alive in a way we never experienced before. We realize that we belong and that we are loved. I found that here. My story isn't particularly dramatic. It's a little dull, in my opinion. There isn't any great, exciting, burning bushes. There's no neglect or abuse. It's just really a story about being affected by somebody else's drinking. And there's been several of those people in my life. So my parents came to this country. They were the children of World War II. So that says a lot about how I was raised. One, they were German. Two, they were children of war. So they came into this world fearful, suspicious, a lot of scarcity, very hard workers, very determined. They left their home country to start a new life here. They left behind family, friends, cousins. I do have extended family there. I don't spend a whole lot of time with them. I have met them. What that meant was when we came here, we didn't have a big safety net. We didn't have a lot of family. We didn't have any family around. It was just the family of four. And we relied upon each other, as dysfunctional as that was. Whatever skills we did or didn't have, and pretty self-reliant, took care of ourselves, hardworking. My parents were in the restaurant business. I always remember having enough. I always made sure we had enough. My parents were loving to my brother and I. We did a lot of stuff together as a family, even though it may not have been super crazy, pretty boring, actually. My mother and I had typical mother-daughter relationship issues, I think, that a lot of women do with their mothers. And that's okay. You know, I've come to terms with it. I have an understanding of it now that is different than it was a long time ago. There wasn't any abuse or neglect. By the time I was in high school, my mom and dad had separated. And I think that really put my mom into a pretty deep depression. And drinking became a pretty big part of her everyday existence. And I think that's how she treated her depression, loneliness. She didn't have a lot of friends, so I didn't learn how to be a good friend or have a network of people to rely on, how to be a friend. I didn't learn how to do that from her. So she was lonely, and she drank a lot at that time. I was a typical teenager. I avoided going home. She wasn't happy about that. My dad lived nearby, so I did spend time with my dad. She went off to college for a little while. My brother went off to school, and my dad moved in with me for a while and made sure I had a home while I went through high school. It was probably my freshman or sophomore year. As Jack said, that's about the time that we met. And it was fun. We grew up in Aspen, which, you know, in the late 70s and the early 80s was quite a time. It was a different time all over the place, but Aspen was particularly liberal with their non-enforcement of rules and watching after the activities. All my friends, you know, we were unsupervised and unmonitored. Jack and I, our relationship was, I think, pretty typical for a very young, immature relationship. We were, you know, there were problems. Whatever those are when you're 14, 15, 16 years old, generally speaking, Jack's problems might have been a little more, and I just assumed that everything was whatever because all my friends were doing the same thing. It's funny because today I see a lot of the people that I went to school with in Aspen are now in our rooms. So I was running with some pretty serious partiers. The best parties were usually at the sheriff's house. There was a lot of drugs and alcohol going on, and I participated in all of that. And usually I went home when I was supposed to go home. Jack didn't always go home, and I would hear about the stories a little bit later, the next day. So I think that started a long pattern of secrets and this other double life and things that were going on that I didn't know about. You know, I think his alcoholism was accelerating. I I would just, you know, it would cause fights. But a lot of his worst behavior went on when I wasn't around. It was like as soon as I went home, he had this other life where he could just do whatever he wanted. There were a lot of secrets and shenanigans that were kept out of my view. And I'm sure it was intentional, because there came a point in our relationship at that time where I was interfering with his drug and alcohol use. I was really, you know, a downhead about it, and it was, I was getting in the way of that. So he broke up with me, just saying. Just saying. I was heartbroken. It was pretty sad. He had been dating my best friend. I'd run into him at a party. She was very short, and he'd be wearing her clothes. So he'd have these little tiny shirts on. It was something else. But I was heartbroken, and I was angry. I begged him, I cajoled him, I harangued him, I called him, you know, and at some point I think I finally kind of gave up on the situation. He talked about his story about when he went into treatment, and I knew he was in trouble. I think I stayed out of it because I wasn't invited in it. I was able to be on my, you know, on my merry way, doing whatever it was that I needed to do, and I, you know, I was dating other people who probably, well, actually one of them, you know, died of alcoholism in his 50s. I was running around with people who were partying too. It was fun. We were unsupervised. We could do whatever we wanted. There was access to a lot of things. It wasn't hard to be involved in that kind of activity. In our relationship, what I realize today, or not in our relationship, but his alcoholism looked a lot like alcoholism then. You know, he was drunk, he was getting DUIs, he was getting in fights, he was getting in trouble, it was real in your face, it was really obvious. So when I found out that he had gone to treatment, I mean, it really wasn't a big surprise. Seemed obvious. Like he said, a friend of ours had also gone into a treatment center. And I was hopeful for him, and I think I was probably hopeful for myself too. After treatment, we did get back together, and I thought all our troubles were behind us. It was his problem, it was taken care of, there was nothing I needed to do. It was none of my business at that point. We were cured, and life was going to go on. We got married. We were very, very young. He asked me. I told him no. We still got married. I don't think I ever said yes, but I definitely showed up on the day we were supposed to get married. Seemed like a really good idea at the time. You know, everybody else was getting married, or at least our friends were getting married. And it was a future. His parents had split up, my parents were split up, and we found a way to have our own family unit. I think we were really looking for stability, and we were gonna create our own future, because everybody else had like gone their own way. At some point in those few years after he got sober, two of his sisters also went through a treatment program, and I don't remember which one it was. I was invited to attend their family program, which I did, and that's where I first heard about Al-Anon. I still have that paperwork. You know, I've looked back at it. I read it. I understood what it was. I understood, you know, that it was for me, but I didn't need it. And it was great for everybody else, but we were fine, because he was sober. Everything was going to be great. Little did I know, So I knew about the slogans, I knew that this existed, but I didn't think I needed it. I thought that if he wasn't drinking, we were going to be fine. I think that I was so young when we got married. I didn't know myself. I had never lived on my own. I was pretty independent and responsible, but I had never lived on my own. I'd always had a boyfriend. I didn't know anything about myself. You know, when you're 20, well, we were 12, right? We were just babies. When you're that young, you just have no idea, and you know, life happens. We got pregnant. We had a baby. We were doing okay, but it was hard. We had no money. It was pretty. I'm amazed we got through it, and I'm sure my parents weren't too thrilled about the situation either. They'd known Jack as long as I had, and I'm sure they didn't think he was the best pick around. I'm sure that was not the future they held for me. You know, it was typical problems. I say typical, it seemed typical. There were money, financial problems, marital problems. We had children, we moved. We moved home because it seemed like a better place to raise children, and I have to say it was. So we left the city where we were living at that time and found our way back to Aspen. We have a close relationship with Jack's parents. We've always lived very near them. At one point, we lived with them. Thank God for my mother-in-law when we were having children. She loved children. And I had no idea. I had never babysat, so I didn't know how to handle any of these things. Jack stayed sober for a long time. You know, he said, you know, maybe 10, 11 years, everything seemed to be going okay as far as I knew. I couldn't tell you that the problems that we were having with money and communication and being married, I couldn't tell you that that was at all related to alcoholism. I had no idea. But alcoholism was alive and well in our house. It was alive and well in our family. By the time he relapsed, I mean, I don't even remember. I guess my son was young. He was two. At this point, we had two children. And it was pretty messy. I didn't give it any thought. You know, I didn't realize that this was alcoholism and it had reared its ugly head again. I don't think that, as far as I can recall, I think he drank that one time, and I think I heard about it maybe months later, and he said, but he's not drinking anymore. And, you know, I think I was just so busy and overwhelmed with all the other problems that were going on that I just moved, you know, I was like, okay, whatever. You got this. I had no idea that I'd been impacted by this. I had no idea that alcoholism was alive and well in our home. And it is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it just hides. Years were going by, and I was, you know, the worse it got, the more I was trying to control. I was trying to control the money. I was trying to control his time. I was trying to control keep all the plates in the air. You know, managing two kids and working, and I didn't feel like I could. He was reliable. I couldn't trust him to, you know, pick up the kids. So I picked up the kids. I couldn't trust him to be on time. So I just didn't expect him to be on time, and I just ended up doing, you know, most everything. At least that's what it seemed like. He was always a good provider. He always went to work. He always came home from work. And that was important to him. And so I'm grateful for that. You know, it wasn't like I was the only one earning the money, you know. I wasn't. We were both working at it. He was always reliable that way. The part where it became a little unreliable was, you know, the money, and, you know, things would go wrong and we couldn't communicate about it and we weren't on the same page. And you know, we talked last night about saying that Al-Anon, or budget, the word budget is an Al-Anon word. I mean, at some point I gave up on a budget because I was the only one working the budget. I mean, at some point you just can't control it. There was a lot of arguing as he became more and more successful in his work. So this is where alcoholism started to look a little different, right? We had money. He had a good job. He had this prestige. He was able to travel. He was traveling on private planes. The money thing started to relax a little bit, but I would come home and there'd be a new truck, and I'm like, where'd the new truck come from? And it was the same model and color as the last one, and it was dark, so I'm like, crazy? What is going on here? He's like, oh no, it's nothing. As he traveled more, he participated less and less in our family. He was just busy. He was busy working. And that took him away from being around. He also had a lot of hobbies that he was busy doing. I got really pretty good at, I hear a lot in the Al-Anon rooms about waiting for the alcoholic to come home because they were out at the bar or whatever. For me, it was waiting at home because I was waiting for him to come home. We didn't have cell phones where you could track anybody. We also lived in the middle of nowhere, so there wouldn't have been any cell service anyway. I didn't know where he was. Say he was going to be home, and then there was something that would be busy, and then he'd be gone. And then he'd go, you know, on the weekends, it was always hunting season, and you'd be surprised how many hunting seasons there are in one year. Who knew there was January elk hunting? And if it wasn't elk hunting, it was fishing, or it was snowmobiling, or whatever. So he was a busy guy. You know, that I had a lot of resentments about that, trying to get him to come home and be around more. I always compare it during that time to carbon monoxide poisoning. I don't know if y'all are familiar with that, but it's really dangerous. You can't see it. You can't smell it. You can't taste it. But boy, it gets in the air in the house, and everybody feels sick. Everybody feels like they have the flu, but nobody knows why. Everybody is just a little out of sorts, and it will kill you. Our family was affected by alcoholism that way. We didn't know what was going on. But boy, alcoholism came back slowly over time and showed up more and more, and we were all sick. You know, there was a lot of fighting. My kids would, I hear about it now, I didn't realize it at the time. They were hiding in their rooms because we were yelling at each other and they didn't know what was gonna happen. They were scared. They were scared we were gonna get a divorce. They were afraid. When he was traveling, little did I know, he was drinking. As far as I knew, he was, he would, you know, he had a lot of pain. He had back pain and tooth pain and ankle pain and knee pain, and we had a lot of pain going on. And there were a lot of pain medications being prescribed, and it was back in the day where, you know, doctors weren't talking to each other, pharmacies weren't talking to each other, and it was accessible, and he was going to Hawaii where he could get it there, and then he could go over here and see an emergency doctor over there. And then he'd come home and get it all filled, and it would, all I knew about was pain and pain medications. That's all I knew about. Things were always unpredictable. I didn't know what was gonna come. I was trying to manage all of this. You know, I was obsessing about what he was doing and where he was, and, you know, I couldn't figure out what was wrong. You know, I assumed that this was just, I don't know, it was just a bad marriage or whatever. We'd been in counseling together, and I wasn't available for my kids. I wasn't present for them. I wasn't able to, you know, be excited about their lives. It was, they'd come home and I'd pick them up, actually, or I'd meet them at the bus, or I'd go on all their things, but I wasn't really present. You know, I think I really missed a lot because I was so busy up here in my head trying to take care of all the things and keep everything, all the plates in the air, and keep everybody happy. At some point, it was probably at least a year before he actually got sober. He came to me and said that he had a problem with prescription drugs. Still had no idea what else was going on. And he was going to do it with doctor supervision, and would I monitor his pill taking? So I would pick up all the prescriptions and keep track of them while he detoxed over, I don't know, 6, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, however long. I think it was years, I swear. I'm an accountant. I can count. There's a balance sheet, right? You know, you take out this many, there should be this many left, and I would have it all on little pieces of paper, and I would give him his pills for the day, and I don't know, I'd go back in there, and there wouldn't be enough, and I'm like, what is going on? It's like, and I'd redo the math, and I'm like, this is crazy, what is happening? And I don't know if he ever got off of them. I don't know if he ever got clean. But I know we did that detox thing at least once, and I'm pretty sure it was at least twice. It was usually over the holidays, so that always made it fun. He was going to meetings. He'd travel to Hawaii. He'd go to a meeting in the morning, 7 a.m. on the beach at the little church on the beach, and he would call me. Done with my meeting, I'm going to work. I had no idea. Apparently he was hungover. But he made that call to make sure that I knew he was in a meeting and he was going to work. And I'd see him in a couple days. And he'd come home for a week or so and then he'd be gone again. After a long time, you know, it was at least a year, he finally came to me and said he really had a problem and he really needed to go do something different about this problem. And for some reason, at this point I'd been in Al-Anon for about a year. I made a commitment to go and learn about it. Of course, I read all the literature before I went, so I knew exactly what I was getting into. I had a moment of clarity and he said, I need to go to treatment. And I went, okay, great. Talk to your sponsor. And I totally stepped out. I don't know what that was about. I'm sure it was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Probably, you know, quiet stuff. Shh, don't say anything. It was such a relief to finally know. And I don't know, maybe 2 days, maybe it was the story that he shared about being out in his shop drinking. I could smell alcohol on his breath, and I was like, what is this? I hadn't smelled alcohol on his breath for 15 years, 20 years. I had no clue. It was kept so in the dark and in secret that I had no clue what was going on. And I find that hard to believe. How could I not known? How could I have not seen the signs? It was well hidden. You know, he did not want me to know that he was drinking. He didn't want me to know anything, but that he definitely didn't want me to know. At this point, I'd already been in the Al-Anon rooms for about a year. It was January, the first meeting that I went, and it was dark, and I can't tell you which day in January it was. It was in the basement of a church, just like every Al-Anon meeting. Well, I guess the one I go to now isn't in the basement, but the next place, it was there too. It was on Monday nights. And I could not understand in step one where it talks about my life being unmanageable. I had some understanding that I was powerless over him and his drinking, but unmanageability just didn't make any sense to me. I was managing everything. I was managing the finances and the kids and the household and those things. So it just, I could not understand how anything was unmanageable because I was managing just fine. And I didn't need any help from anybody. I had it. That meeting in Basalt, they started a noon one, and it was a literature meeting. And I think there were only three of us, and I'm sure I was the only newcomer. And I know now that they had to have been talking to each other, finding out if I was going to be there on that at noon. And we read the literature basically line by line. I don't remember how long it took. I don't remember if we went through the whole book, but I know that there were people there for me as a newcomer, and they wanted to be there so that if I showed up in that noon meeting, they would be there, and Al-Anon would be there for me. I was seeking. I was looking for connection. I knew I couldn't cure his alcoholism. I knew I didn't cause it. I had tried to control it, but I knew that I couldn't. I knew that I needed some help. And I just kept coming to that meeting. My first sponsor, she used to say, I think when you're new, you don't always work the program of Al-Anon, but Al-Anon works you. And just by coming, I was able to be around people who talked about their recovery in Al-Anon. I'm so grateful for that. I was a regular attendee. People, you know, shared their stories, and I was starting to see some similarities, and I could start to relate to it, and I could start seeing some answers. I could start hearing the answers to some of the problems that I was having. And because he was now sober and going to AA, he was busy doing his thing, so he was gone all the time again. But I now had this new way of thinking about things and starting to take care of myself a little differently. I don't know, it was a couple years, I don't remember what year it was, but Jack came home all on fire about these people from Texas, and they was just the greatest thing, and I'm like, Texas? Really? Little did I know, or I guess I hadn't put it all together yet, but Karen was in our rooms, and she had talked to Don, and Don was, you know, she was like, yeah, I think she is in my room, so we started, you know, talking, and I, you know, where I'm from, we're all outdoorsy and, you know, very sensible shoes, not a whole lot of makeup, and I don't know if you guys knew Don and Karen, but when they came anywhere, you know, she always was fully made up, her hair was done, there was, you know, jewelry and furs and always looked good, and it was just not something I could relate to. So when Jack came to me one day, he said, they want us to go to Texas to a conference. And I'm like, oh, God. I don't want to go to Texas. We're going to go to the AA capital of the world. And he had so much enthusiasm for this. I'm like, oh, God. And Karen was putting on pressure. And finally, I said yes. I was scared. I didn't know what to expect. I got down there, and we went to our first conference down there, and holy cow. I don't know if any of y'all have been to Texas. It's a whole different experience down there. And the conference that we went to was AA and Al-Anon together. Nobody's had anything on there that said anything about their affiliation. Everybody shared together. Everybody ate together. Everybody went to meetings together. Everything was together. There was no delineation. There was nobody standing outside that door going, Al-Anon. Nobody knew. Because their thought was, if we got sick together, we're going to get well together. And like Jack said, we did meetings and socials, and it was so overwhelming to me because they were so kind and so generous and so loving and wanted to talk to me. And I really am an introvert, and I'm like, I don't know who all these people are, and it's so weird. Y'all are so weird. You eat weird. You talk weird. You talk kind of funny. Coming from that German family, you know, I was very suspicious and untrusting. I didn't know, didn't want to know, but I, for some reason, said yes, and we had a great time. Jack talked about my experience there. It was unbelievable, really, the way they said, you know, come on in, come to our house, we're going to have another meeting. And the meetings were different than anything I'd ever been in. You know, it was AA and Al-Anon together, and the alcoholics weren't talking about drinking alcohol. They were talking about this spiritual program and their solution. And it was we're all in this together. When Karen would come for the summers to Carbondale, one summer she brought, they were Marcy's steps. Marcy was her sponsor, and Marcy had sponsored a bunch of women, and she'd done it enough times they'd actually written it all down. And it was a group of women, AA and Al-Anon women together, and we worked the steps together. In a group, every week, it was a commitment. If you didn't work step four, or it was one of the early ones, you were booted. You know, it was a commitment. You signed a commitment. I'm going to do this with you people. We're going to get through it. We did it in maybe 12 or 14 weeks. If you didn't do your fifth step, you didn't come back. And if you didn't do your homework, you didn't share. And it was an experience I'd never had before. And I'd already worked the steps at that point. But this was a deeper, richer experience. We'd go around the room, we'd talk about how each step affected, what our experience was that week. We didn't share our fifth step with everybody in the room, but we shared our experience about it. You know, what did we learn about it? What was new? What was not new? The relationships that I developed in that room, the first group, it was like 35 women. We did it again like another year later, and it was more. And most people didn't drop out. You know, most people stayed committed through the whole thing. I think it really changed my trajectory. Karen and Don, you know, swept us up. They showed us how to live this program every day in our daily lives, how this program gives me the solutions to all my problems, whether it's money, friends, marriage, children, work, everything. Anything that came up, I could find the solution there. And now I had a whole network of women that I never had before who could share with me their experience. Many of them had many more years than me, and some of my richest friendships are with AA women. The AA women could talk to me about alcoholism in a way that I couldn't hear it from Jack. You know, his was like, you know, Charlie Brown's parrot, womp, 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 and he would just drone on and on about it. And I'm like, I couldn't hear it from him to get understanding about alcoholism. But I could hear it from these women. They could explain to me what alcoholism was and how it showed up in their life. And when I talked to them about my concerns about my mom, they were able to say something in a way that I could understand what was happening for her. What I also found and what I understand now, is that we all have very similar defects of character. We all control. We all manipulate. We all obsess. It's just manifests a little differently. The alcoholic wants to control so that they can control and keep drinking. The Al-Anon, I want to control so that you stop drinking. It's still control. The solution is still the same. It's still through the steps with a power greater than myself who can remove it. I just got to be willing. I got to be humble. I got to be honest. And I think that's what works for the alcoholics too. That's what I've seen. Self-centeredness. In our rooms, it's hard to talk about self-centeredness because we're always all about you. And you know, in Al-Anon, we talk about keep the focus on ourselves. That doesn't mean that I'm going to do what I want and that I'm going to be selfish and self-seeking. That just means I'm going to clean my side of the street, have an understanding of why I'm doing this or doing whatever the behavior is, and so that I can ask for help, work the steps, talk to others, and not talk about the alcoholic. I think it says in our preamble, we keep the focus on ourselves and not on the alcoholic. That is a constant daily reminder. I have to keep the focus on myself and not on the alcoholic. I have to remember that all the time. We talk about people-pleasing and how that's all about somebody else. And I think that's really, I think people-pleasing is a really self-centered thing because it's not about you, it's about me. I want to keep you happy so that I don't feel afraid or scared or I'm not going to get what I need. I've worked those steps a couple of times. I've worked them in a different group. I've worked them in different ways. Every time the results seem to be the same and very different. A lot of times those character defects come up, but it's some new relationship. Some new current relationship, whether it's somebody at work or it's somebody new in the program or some new friendship that I've developed, it's still the same character defects that Steph is still showing up. And those character defects still show up. Does that mean they never go away? Maybe. Maybe it's just part of who I am. Have they softened? Have the edges come off of them? Yeah. And when I'm scared, those character defects really, really surface. 100 forms of fear. I know that that's talked about in the big book. 100 forms of fear. You know, the fear inventory has been really important because then I get a real understanding of what I'm afraid of. You know, what am I afraid of? Somebody, I don't remember who said it this weekend, you know, it's, I'm not going to get what I want, or you're going to take something that I already have. That pretty much sums it up. I'm still discovering and uncovering stuff. I'm still learning about myself. And sometimes it's, you know, 20-some years later, I'm working the steps, and it's like, oh, there you are. There it is again. There you are obsessing over that again. For me, the steps are now just like a part of my life. It isn't that I'm working them always in sequential order. They kind of all just kind of blend together. And every day there's some situation or some thought that I have that I need, you know, some sort of guidance and clarity. And I can always come back to the steps. After learning some more about the traditions, that kind of comes into play now too. You know, it's now I know a little bit more about myself. Now I can start talking to the world and talking about or interacting with the world together, right? So that I'm not always in control. We always laugh that Jack always says we're going to work as a team and we're going to do it my way. Which never, I was like, no, we're not. And we still butt heads. I mean, that's just the way it is. But today, you know, that edge comes off a lot quicker than it used to. I can't imagine being in a relationship with anybody who isn't in one of these programs. You know, these are the, I call them the rules of engagement, but we all speak the same language. We all talk about the same solution. The solution that keeps the alcoholic sober is the one that keeps the Al-Anon serene. We're all in this together. In the steps I learn about me, and in the traditions and the concepts, I learn about how to show up in the world and how to play with others. I've done some other leadership programs. These same principles all come up. You know, they're not original. They are just in a way that I can hear them. I can apply them to my life. We started because we were involved in it when we were down in Texas. There, you know, home meetings with couples. So I don't know. We started it before COVID. I don't think we met over COVID, but we get together. We've got maybe six or seven couples get together once a month. We rotate houses. We've done the steps. We've gone through the traditions. We just went through the concepts, and we have, you know, however many, 12 or 14 different perspectives on that. And it's all equal sharing. Everybody's open to everybody's ideas. Sometimes reading those concepts, man, they are just, when I was first in this program, it was just, my eyes would roll back in my head. It was so dry, and I couldn't apply it to anything in my life. And I'm so glad today that there's other people who can talk about it or who have some experience with it, who have shared with me in ways that it makes sense to me. I'm going to give a plug for leadership again, the literature table again. We have amazing literature in Al-Anon, lots and lots of literature. There's a new book that are not new anymore, but it's got a binder on and it's green, and it is amazing. Our group, you know, the first meeting of the month is a step meeting, and the third one is a tradition meeting, and that's what the topic is. We aren't talking about anything else, whether it's somebody new or not. We've had talk about if there's a newcomer, maybe we should do a 1, 2, or 3 meeting, but here's what I find. Newcomers come in, and then we're doing 1, 2, and 3. Newcomers leave, and then another week later, another one comes in, and we end up just talking about steps 1, 2, and 3. And it's okay if we can make those traditions relatable or those concepts relatable to today and our relationships. The newcomer is going to get something out of it. It's another way to feel, you know, look for the similarities and not the differences. I talked a little bit about sponsorship. I'm on my second sponsor. Thank God for my first sponsor. She was great and gentle and took me through the steps and was loving and kind and was really patient with me. It took me forever to get through the steps the first time, like a year. Forever. I'm a procrastinator. So working in a group with a commitment, I can do them. And I'm way more productive and it's much more effective for me. I sponsor others. And every time I meet with them, I'm learning something about myself. Because they're asking me, you know, this is what happened. And then I can remember something and I went, oh yeah, that's how this can solve this problem. You know, that's how this tradition can resolve this problem. People at work, you know, they're working a lot and they don't know what to do. And it's like, I don't know, what's your primary spiritual aim? They're a teacher. What is your primary spiritual aim at work? Or, you know, are you taking care of yourself? Are you giving yourself enough time, sleep, things like that, going to meetings? After we worked those steps in that group, and we weren't going to work the steps again, that group of women, we wanted to stay together. We wanted to keep meeting because we loved the interaction that we were having. So we did a book study. We'd pick a book. Wasn't always conference approved. In fact, it probably wasn't most of the time. and we'd read some spiritual book. It needed to be, the only requirement was that it was 12-step related. Could have been a whole book on meditation. And then we'd pick another one. It usually wasn't, you know, fiction or anything, but it was maybe about somebody in recovery or some other spiritual piece of literature, and we would read it every week and come back and talk about how it affected us and how we could relate to it. That's important because I now have this resource of people that I can talk to, that I'm already comfortable with, that I have an intimate relationship with. And I am so grateful for that. I was looking for that when I came here. I was looking for connection with other people, because it is lonely living with alcoholism at home alone. It's a serious disease. And you can die of loneliness sitting at home. From what I understand, I don't know if it's facts or what, but you know, it's not unusual for the Al-Anon to be sick physically or die first. It's not unusual. Our current world, there are plenty of challenges. Jack's had some health problems the last, I don't know, 5 years. I don't know how long it's been. It seems like it's forever. How do I let him have the dignity to take care of himself? How do I get out of the way? How do I not control it and try to manipulate him and get him to do what I think is right? How do I stay out of that? How do I be supportive and loving and just do what I need to do without controlling it? That's an often thing. I talked earlier, or what was it, yesterday, we talked about the traditions, and we're a family that works together. Got grown children. We run two businesses. We're very busy. We have employees, and we're working. We try not to show up too much like a family. I don't parent my kids anymore. At least I don't think I do. You know, they're autonomous. They make decisions, and we want that business to be theirs. So we have to step back and let them do it. We want them to do it, and we just step back more and more. One of the names of our businesses is Concept One Group, and the other one is The Home Group. Nobody really knows what that means except for us. But it's a reminder to us all the time, you know, that the program is alive and well, working in the background in our family business. It's not always easy, but both of my kids have an understanding of these recovery programs. When Jack first got sober, my son was so proud of himself at, I don't know, how old is he, maybe 13 or 14 years old, he had more sobriety than his dad. And he would run around with Jack and his buddies, and he'd go to conferences, and he'd go out to Grand Junction, and they'd go see Clancy, and they'd go see all these people, and my son would go along as the little mascot with all these alcoholics and drive all over the state and go see these amazing speakers. So he knows what's out there. He understands. My daughter, we'd go down to conferences down on the Front Range, and she knew it was a free dinner if we showed up down there, and it usually meant her friends and maybe even a little shopping. So the unspoken thing was she had to come to the meeting. She had to come to the conference and listen to the speakers. She was happy to. She loved it. I'm grateful to say that she's been in the program now, I think, 16 years. It has changed her life. And we can speak the same language. We attend meetings together. Most people don't even know we're related, which is how it should be. Nobody needs to know. You know, we're anonymous in these rooms in that regard. It doesn't matter. We've been affected by the family disease of alcoholism. She talks about living with alcoholism. I talk about living with alcoholism. Sometimes it can be a little raw, but but it's not very often because I've heard her talk about it before. So I'm going to try and wrap this up, and I like to talk about at the end of this because it feels like a good way to close, is, you know, the contact, conscious contact with our higher power. There's been a lot that's gone on in our life. We've been married 41 years this year. That's a long freaking time. That's a lot of relationships. And I told you a little about those relationships. We have teenage relationship, we have sober relationship, we have a relapse relationship, now we have sobriety again. It took me 20 years to get here. And I've been here a little over 20. That's, you know, that's a lot. It's 2/3 of my life. What I have come to find, what my experience has shown me, what I have experienced, that whatever happens, I'm going to be okay. Might be scary. It's going to be messy. As Fonzie said, sometimes it gets sloppy. I'm going to be okay. But it might not look like I think it. I want it to look. I think I talked about it yesterday, you know, ask God to see this in a different way. And a lot of times I just have to say that out loud, and I'm able to stop doing my own thinking and know that I'm going to be okay and that there's going to be something on the other side of it. Jack talked a little bit about our legal thing, and I said to him, as I don't know whether it was year 5 we were into that thing, I said, maybe we're just here for those people who are having that experience. We're just part of their experience. This isn't about us. They lost their family, and we just get to be there and be honest and show up and let them process their grief. I had no idea. You know, who knows? But we were okay. And we were okay when we were in it. It was still painful, and it was still uncomfortable, but I've always been okay. There's been so many opportunities for growth and so many times of peace and clarity. And there were lots of pause. I know that there's been people praying for me. Jack talked about it a little bit. The people in our lives are prayer warriors. I think there's a lot of prayer that goes on. You can call it prayer, you can call it energy, you can call it whatever you want to call it. I think it's just what it is. It's something that is unexplainable, and I think it's magic. That's been in my experience. I can't say God did this or God did that. It just happened. I don't know why. It's just magic. It just happened. And it impacted me. Prayers for me. It's not for God. God's already knows. God's already got this. It's to relieve me so that I feel, so that I can connect with that higher power and this other power. I think we all kind of connect. I don't know how many of you seen Finding Nemo. Remember when they're trying to get to Australia, and they're swimming, and he runs in, I can't remember the dad's name, he runs into the little turtle. What is he, little dude? Something like that. Big dude, whatever he was. He's like, where's the EAC, the Eastern Australian Current? Because he knew that if he got into that current, he could get to Australia with very little effort. He just got in it, and he was carried. He knew he was looking for that. And he runs across this little turtle who says, hey, come on, let's go. And he shows him where it is. He says, come on, and it gets all exciting, and he gets in there, and they're flipping about, and they get in this current that is just carrying them. He goes, dude, just grab shell. And they're flying through, and there's this wise old turtle that's taking them along. That's what prayer is like for me. I just get into that current, I plug in, and I'm carried. People have carried me. They've carried us through that. They've carried us through many other things. I remember when my daughter was giving birth to our second grandchild, her second child, and it wasn't going well. And it had gone on for a long time, and it was really scary. But I knew as we sat there, there was a point where there was like, the midwife's like, listen, you got to focus. We're going to do this, and we're going to get it done. And it got quiet, and it got dark, and we just sat there, and we plugged in. And we were carried, and everything was okay. Sure was scary for a while, and it was moving fast. But we plugged in, grabbed Shell, and it was quite a ride. So thank you for all of you who pray for us. I'll pray for you.
So my wife has trouble getting up here, so she asked me to finish, but